You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Colette Fair. We talk about marriage and divorce. This is one of the most popular topics that people want to share here on this show. I talk about it. I get to talk about it a lot, not as much as Colette. This show, my show, is about personal stories of choices and change and the impact of those decisions on the path of your life. So what we talk about is Colette's actual personal experience with her first marriage and divorce. Here's where it gets a little interesting in this conversation, though, because after her divorce, Colette actually became a therapist. She went back to school. So she's got the double whammy of her own personal experience and professional training and working with clients. Whatever your relationship status is today, I think this conversation has a lot to offer, and I'm excited to share it with you today. So let's do it. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Colette Fair, are you ready for a fun chat today?
I can't wait.
Yay, I'm so excited. Share with us what part of the world you call home.
So I am in Orlando, Florida, but the funny thing is I've been here for 29 years and I almost still don't think of this as home. I'm a New Yorker, like so many Floridians.
Yes.
So when I think home, I still think New York, even though I really love living in Florida too.
That's so fun. All right, though, here's a fun question. Even though you think of New York as home, what's something that you love or enjoy about where you actually live, Orlando?
The eternal sunshine, wearing flip-flops in January, right? I mean, you just can't beat it. It's such an easy, nice life. And I love that there are so many people from all over the world here that call this home. It's like a true melting pot in the best way.
What a fantastic answer. All right. Today, we're going to talk about marriage and divorce. Are you ready?
I am ready. This is all I talk about all day, every day. And I love this topic. So let's do it.
Very cool. To kick this off, how many times have you been married and or divorced?
Well, don't. We're not at the end of the road here. So we'll see what the final is. But I'm just kidding. I'm married now for the second time. So two marriages, one divorce.
All right. Those are the statistics. How old were you, if you don't mind sharing, when you first got married, and how many years did that marriage last?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because, like I said, I'm from New York. The typical trajectory for my cohort of friends, and I think a lot of people in New York, especially now, but I'm 52. So this is going back, you know, I was in college in the early to mid 90s. Is that people were getting married in their 30s, in their early 30s. But I met my first husband at 18 years old on the first day of college. I went to Tulane in New Orleans. And so we got married. We got engaged when I was 23, married at 24, which was very unusual for my group of friends. And I was divorced at 31. So the marriage lasted 7 years. And fun fact is that the year I got divorced, I was in 10 weddings because all of my friends were just getting married that year. And I was already getting divorced. And not only that, I had a one-year-old and a three-year-old.
So, wow. Oh, that is super interesting. How did that feel to be going through all those weddings as an attendee? Were you like a bridesmaid and all the things?
I was a bridesmaid. I think a couple of them, I think I was a maid of honor. I was a bridesmaid in many of those weddings. And in fact, one wedding that was 2 months almost to the day after my divorce was final, was in the same church where I got married, same reception. So my friend had actually reached out to me and said, you know, if you don't want to be in the wedding party, I would totally understand. And I said, no, this day is about you. Let's keep it that way. And then I hooked up with a really cute groomsman after having a few too many drinks. And that made the whole thing more palatable, but it was hard.
That's like a movie. That could be
right? That
could be a Hallmark movie, you know, like about the wedding theme and hooking up from the wedding party and all of those things.
You're right, Amy. We should like co-write that. And Get rich immediately.
Right. That is the goal. That is the goal. Okay, so I want to back up for just a second, and talk about the marriage, right? Because we talk about marriages ending, but it's not just the ending that happened. A lot of the ideas that we have and the concepts we have about marriage, and you sort of touched on this with talking about your cohort of friends was on a different calendar, but we have ideas about what marriage and family are supposed to look like based on what we grow up with. Share a little bit. This is not your story. It's that I'm asking you about. It's your parents, but share a little bit about what your parents' marriage looked like for you as a kid.
Yeah, no, I appreciate this question so much as a therapist and a person. And I like to bring this to the table, even though my parents don't love it so much. The truth
Right.
is, yeah, they don't, they're like, don't talk about us and our messy stuff. But it's important because it does inform what we look for, both consciously and unconsciously. And we really only operate about 5% out of the conscious anyway. So these things are important, what's modeled in our family. And I have wonderful parents. I'm close to both of them. My dad's a doctor. My mom's a lawyer, both very smart, very outspoken. And my early childhood was really genuinely pretty idyllic. Now, I don't know what was going on in their marriage that I wasn't aware of during those years, but I didn't have any siblings. We traveled together. My parents read to me. We did arts and crafts. I ran around the neighborhood with a pack of kids, like most Gen Xers. It was wonderful. And then when I was about 11 years old, I now know my father had an affair and there were a host of other issues going on in the marriage. My parents had a baby, where I later learned my brother that this was kind of a last ditch effort to save the marriage that did not work. And they began to argue. And this is why I mentioned how they're both very outspoken. You know, I'm half Italian, half Irish. I already said I'm a New Yorker. The conflict was really loud and destructive. Their memory of it is that it was a very brief blip. My memory of it was that it was groundbreaking, traumatic, earth-shattering. It felt like it was my entire middle school life that I lay in bed listening to my parents argue with a stomach ache. And what's interesting is that I remember consciously, literally saying to myself, when I grow up, I'm going to have a perfect marriage. I'm going to marry someone that I never argue with. It's going to be so peaceful. And I mean, it's no surprise then, really, that I picked someone who really never addressed any conflict at all, came from a family that was very genteel and polite. Nobody ever seemed upset. And I really thought that was the answer. I didn't understand that we have to be able to address conflict, but we have to do it constructively.
So there's a lot in there. You've clearly
Yes.
had this conversation before, but you're not the first person that I've met or I've run across who draws the conclusion as a child that a successful marriage is one, or a successful friendship, or a successful business partnership is defined by the fact that there's no conflict.
Yeah, easy.
And
We
yeah,
want to get
and
along. Yeah.
right, you want to get along and therefore just skips over all of the lessons that are needed to handle conflict, because I have yet to find a partnership that doesn't involve at least some negotiation.
Absolutely. Conflict is inevitable, and actually, it's the greatest source of emotional intimacy and connection we have if we know how to lean into it constructively, if we know how to communicate and we're willing to share our inner world. Now, I had to learn all of this by having a failed marriage. I mean, because the problem is when you avoid conflict, it creates distance, it leads to resentment, it creates disconnection, not to mention that it actually also compromises our health to suppress our emotions. But really, what I've learned as a therapist is the number one factor that destroys relationships is emotional disconnection, not arguing, not having differences, not even infidelity. It's disconnection. So you're right. Most people, I hear it on my couch every day too. People like me saying, oh my God, all I wanted was to not argue. And of course, because of some factors with attachment science, you know, it's a real tricky thing. It's natural that we're scared of conflict, but we have to learn how to address it constructively.
So off topic from your marriage and the divorce, how much of your decision to pursue being a therapist as a career do you think was influenced by your middle school years listening to your parents fight?
I think it was half that, half my own divorce.
Ah,
Those
okay.
two, yeah, those two together. But you know what, actually, Amy, really, when I think about it, I think the seeds for becoming a therapist were there early because what would end up happening, and I'm sure you hear this from so many people too. I was an only child during these years. Then my brother was a baby. And only children are often adultified, as we say in therapy, or parentified. And children of divorce are almost always adultified and parentified, especially in previous generations
Right.
when we didn't have all this attention on how to divorce well that thank God we have now. So I think I was sort of my dad's unofficial therapist. He has since apologized to me profusely because he would inappropriately, it's kind of astonishing to me because I have the best dad, but he would tell me the details of his life, ask me for advice. I mean, I was 12, 13 years old. And
Yeah.
then my mom was very upset and hurt and wounded. And so I would kind of manage and moderate all of her emotions and try to regulate mom so that she wasn't so distressed. Or I would triangulate between them and say, well, I think where mom's coming from. And this is literally what I am doing now for a living as a couples therapist,
That
right?
is, yeah, no, that is really interesting. And I do think that it's fair to shed a spotlight on the fact that in the 80s, which is, I think, when this was happening,
Yes.
there were not online chat groups and there was no Facebook or Reddit. It was harder to do that. It was harder to find people. There was an enormous stigma still about getting divorced for people that
Yes.
age. My parents divorced when I was very young, and I was today, everybody is familiar with it, but I remember it being unusual. Like it was like
Yes.
there weren't everybody wasn't didn't have parents
Oh
who were
my gosh.
divorced.
And Amy, I grew up in a part of New York. You know, New York is the ultimate melting pot, but New
Yeah.
York is also very like cultural by neighborhood. So where I grew up was a town outside of New York City that was all Irish Catholic. I went to all girls Catholic school. I did not know one person who got a divorce. I did not have one friend, not one.
Yeah.
So talk about something. And my parents in our family, there was no divorce ever. So the irony is that my parents did not believe in divorce, did not want a divorce. And this whole thing went on, started when I was 11, and they didn't get divorced until I was in college
Oh my
because they
goodness.
had, yes, because they had this belief of you don't get divorced. And I remember when they finally announced it to me, I said, oh my God, thank God. I've been telling you to get a flipping divorce for 8 years, right? Like you guys are not good together. And now my parents are great friends. They get along great. I know it's been a long time, but not everyone has that. So there was no support group for my parents. No one was talking about the psychological impact really on kids or sending kids to therapy or, you know, don't discuss your issues in front of the children. We had Kramer versus Kramer, which was like a big movie in the
Yep.
70s, and War of the Roses.
Oh,
And that
that
was
is a
about
great
it.
movie.
Yes. And my parents were a little like that at certain times.
So they were living in the same house until you had moved out. You went to New
They
Orleans and
separated on
okay.
and off. My dad at one point lived two doors down from the house. I mean, it was all kinds of messy and dysfunctional. However, I will say this one thing, and this goes a long way. Not that they didn't make mistakes, but I always felt loved. Both of them I knew were there for me. I knew they had my back. At times they were too distracted to be there for me the way they should have. However, I always felt loved and connected. And I think that goes a long, long way. And
It is,
because of
yes.
this, I did my thesis in grad school on like the damage to kids out of divorce. And really, the research shows, and you probably already know this, that if you divorce well and you co-parent well, your kids are going to turn out just as well as if you stayed married. It's negative, destructive conflict in marriage or in divorce that harms children.
So I one time, so my parents divorced when I was young, and probably like And there were complications and things like that. And I grew up with that same story that you're talking about, which is that like divorce is horrible, the kids suffer, all these things. And when I got to be an adult, I was like, that is not really kind of what happened in my family. Like the divorce was the start of like safe spaces and healing for my family. And I said that about 10 years ago. I mentioned that in like a group on Facebook, which is a terrible place to actually put anything about anything. And I, like, people were just like, no, all divorces are destructive and bad for kids. And I was like, I just don't know if that's always, I mean, it can be for sure, absolutely. But there are so many times where it's the conflict that is, or the unhealthiness, or whatever. I mean, your story, you touch on it. It sounds like there was not like one of those big catastrophes that is so horrible, like substance use, mental health disorders, those things. Those are really big problems in families that rip things apart. And it doesn't sound like you had that.
No, for sure. I mean, there was infidelity, though,
Infidelity, which is a big one.
it's very inflammatory. Emotions were very high. But, even my own divorce experience, I think there are ways, certainly, that I suffered in the short term.
Yes.
But had my parents stayed married, those ways would have been there. And I personally believe, just zooming out a little, that this idea that's still there, even though we've come a long way from the 80s, but that divorce hurts children and divorce is so bad. I think it's part of the patriarchy and keeping women in something that increasingly, in many cases, doesn't serve women well. I mean, when you look at divorce, more than 70% are initiated by women. Divorce rates are steady, except for the gray divorce segment at that empty nest phase, which is growing because marriage is now not just an economic proposition. We really do want emotional intimacy. We want friendship. We want equality. We want partnership. We no longer are interested in being domestic indentured servants. So
No, we are not.
No, and not that we ever were, but women used to not get divorced because they didn't have a choice. And sadly, there are still many women there. The finances are not such that they feel they can leave. But this narrative of you can't leave because of the kids. Now, I'm not saying if that's not your individual truth that you're not. You don't want to see your kids
Right.
50% of the time, and what's happening in the marriage doesn't feel so bad to you. That everybody's got to make their own cost benefit analysis. But I just think there are still these prevailing narratives that are
Yeah.
designed to keep women small and complacent and in order that don't serve us.
I tend to agree, and that is my opinion. All right. So I love everything you said there. Today, you have a lot more experience with life than you did on your wedding day. Thinking back about that original decision you made to get married at a young age, do you think you were at any way aware of the experience of your childhood and how that was impacting that decision?
I was aware of it, but it was imp and I thought I was choosing wisely because of it, but it was actually impacting me in some unconscious ways that really were sabotaging me, meaning, I sought out somebody who we try to heal our old wounds in these new relationships, but I sought somebody, we end up all of us, and I did the same thing, seeking somebody who's also familiar, but it
Yeah.
feels like a better version. So there were elements of my first husband and his family dynamic that were familiar, elements with like infidelity, but then it seemed like the antidote that they were so conflict avoidant and nobody was ever upset. I thought that was better. And actually, I picked someone who really. And he'll even admit this today. He's done a lot of work, my ex-husband, and is remarried. So I'm not trying to slam him in any way, but he was very emotionally disconnected. So I really sought out something that I thought was the answer as a result of what I experienced as a child, but was actually a new problem
Yeah.
that, that was bigger in a way and harder.
So you use the word unconscious, and I'm going to say, this sounds to me like you had a plan, you did some thinking, but as you learned more and went through it, it turned out it wasn't a good plan. It wasn't the right plan. So, but there's no way to know that. So the question is, was it unconscious, or was some of it because you just can't actually know what something's going to be like until you get into it?
I love that question. I think it was both. I really think it was both. I think that knowing what I know now, I've been doing this work for 14 years. I work with a tremendous volume of couples. I also do discernment counseling, which is should I stay or should I go?
Oh, I didn't know that word, discernment counseling.
Yes, it's its
Okay.
own model of counseling because, good couples therapy is about let's repair and rebuild the bond. And if somebody's really leaning out, you have to address that question first because both people have to be ready to roll up their sleeves and work. You can't get into couples therapy. So discernment counseling is only 1 to 5 sessions focused on, are we going to work on it or are we going to call the ball? So I think with what I see now, there are things that I would have been aware of are going to be a huge problem that
Yeah.
I just didn't understand. Like, for example, looking at the way when we'd argue, the behavioral patterns, the way when I expressed emotions, the way I was or wasn't responded to. Those were all signs of emotional disconnection and emotional unavailability within that person who also grew up in a family where they had their own issues and he learned his own coping mechanisms. Now, we could have worked on those things together,
Yeah.
but it didn't go that way. And I love that you asked this question, Amy, because it really is, I think, the smug married people, as Bridget Jones once said, people who are happy, think they're so proud of themselves. A lot of it is luck. You do not know what's coming in that gift bag. You think you do, but much of the time, especially for those of us who get married the first time younger in life, you don't know what you don't know until years and life have exposed certain realities.
Sure, because part of the courtship process to learn, use like a super old set of words, is that we show each other what we think they want to see and what we think are the best parts of us. And that's not, it could be manipulative, sure, but it's also just what we do. It's like you don't walk in for the job interview and say, "Hey, let me list for you all the reasons I'm bad for this job."
Yes, exactly. Chris Rock, a million years ago in the early 90s, said, you don't date someone, you date their representative. Like in
Yeah.
that first year. And it is so true. And it's not me. There, like you said, there are some people who maybe are manipulative, but most of us, it's just the reality. It's exciting. You're getting to know people. You're not bringing your most unflattering parts forward. And also, in fairness, life hasn't pushed on you yet. And the relationship in those ways. But then you get a house with someone, you live with them, you manage stressful careers, you have children, you have all the unexpected crises life throws at you, have the day in and day out of that intimate level of living with somebody. Everybody is difficult at that level in their own
Oh
way.
my gosh, I tell people this all the time. Just not, I am not a therapist. You're a therapist. But I tell people all the time, it's hard to live with people. It's just
Oh,
hard
yeah.
to live with people. It's
Anyone.
anyone,
Anyone.
anyone. All right. So I just said this. I'm not a therapist. You are. This profession, you became a therapist after the divorce?
Yes, and actually, my divorce, and to your point, probably my whole childhood, is what led me to become a couples therapist. But very specifically, because, and I think this is so important for listeners to know. We went to a marriage counselor who had come highly recommended, my first husband and I. This person was terrible, and I would not say that lightly. Terrible to the point of some things were even unethical. And I was young, I didn't know anything about psychology or counseling. Today, I would report this person to the board for some of the things that they did. So it's just so important to, if you're going to go to couples therapy or therapy at all, find somebody who is experienced and trained specifically in couples therapy. It's really important.
And you have
But
to ask.
you have to
You
ask
have to ask. I went through
how
that.
many, yes.
I went through that not in couples therapy. Well, couples therapy. My parents were divorced when I was young. So my plan was that we were going to do premarital therapy, and then we'd never have any problems. It was a plan. I'm a step parent. My husband has children, and we were working with a therapist who had no experience with that construct, which eventually came out in that, he was doing his best, but he wasn't offering me
Didn't
things
have
that
any
were,
experience.
didn't have any experience and didn't come up until like I asked. And he was like, I've never considered that. And I was like, oh, this is like shopping for groceries in Home Depot,
Exactly. What a great metaphor. Yeah. And, it's a problem in the field that more people need to be aware of that you are, if you're a licensed therapist, you're allowed to work with couples, but you really shouldn't because individual therapy and couples therapy are a completely different process. So, your therapist doesn't necessarily have to have lived every life experience or worked with a couple just like you, but you do want someone who's trained in couples therapy and blended family issues. I'm a stepmom too. If somebody hasn't worked with that, it's going to be very hard to know how to help you effectively. So I saw that there was a problem that we need more good couples counselors. It's not an easy job. And I went to grad school. I mean, I had those little babies I told you. I hadn't worked for a few years. I was so young. I barely had a career trajectory, but what I had was in sales and marketing. And I got a job immediately out of the divorce back in that field and thought, this isn't for me. It's not rewarding to me personally. I want to do something to help people. And that's why I did this.
That is a testament to your fortitude and your, I don't even know what the right word is, but to go back to school with young children is not easy to retool. It's a long path in graduate school to get licensed and approved for therapy. I mean, it's a really hard academic path. And I do think it's a really tough job. It's like, being involved with people. So kudos to that.
Thank
Okay,
you.
so when you guys, I think you answered this question already. So when you guys, when your first marriage, when you realized that it wasn't going the way you thought it would, did you reach out to, you reached out to a therapist at the time? You guys did some couples therapy.
We didn't do it early enough. We did it at the brink of divorce when everything was already a disaster. And I didn't realize for all the issues that were there. I really thought they were all my husband, as many of us do. And I didn't realize the conflict avoidant piece and how much it had disconnected us. And I didn't realize that I had lost my voice. I wanted to communicate. I thought I was communicating, but it was indirect hinting, hoping my needs would be magically mind read, getting passive aggressive, doing what I call victim volcano syndrome, where I would take it and take it and take it and then eventually blow. And, I was very much a product of what's still there, which is, I call it good girl-itis, that we're still praised for being small and selfless and seen as noble when we put our needs last. So I was trying to be that, but all the while I was avoiding sharing my own feelings and needs clearly, and resentment was building up. So when we got to the point of counseling, I felt like I kind of hated him. And it was really, I'll never know for sure if it was too late or not, but it felt too late and the whole thing blew up in spectacular fashion. So that's part of my mission is I don't want to force everyone to stay together. That's not the right path, but I want to help the people that really do. A lot of people, if it could be better, they want it. I want to help those people make it better.
100%. All right. So some of the things that you've described in this conversation, and also I think in the pitch, are being a people pleaser, being conflict avoidant, that kind of thing. I'm not a therapist. You are. You can correct me as the professional if what I say is off base. One of the things I was thinking about when I was thinking about did you have a therapist is that sometimes that whole people pleasing thing is directly related to the word I think the word we sometimes use is trauma, but maybe it's the wrong word. But the things that come up in our childhood, and did anybody ever, did you realize, did anybody ever talk to you about the fact that some of the ways you were showing up actually could be trauma responses from what you had experienced?
No, absolutely not. I never heard that or thought of that or no.
No. So do you think that now, but now you draw a conclusion. It's like, yes, what I saw when I was a kid showed up again when I was an adult.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. I'm just thinking in real time. I think it's a couple of these threads coming together. I think it's the societal piece
Sure, because we
about
do,
like,
and we do still praise girls for being quiet
yes,
and good. That hasn't
and
stopped.
nice.
I would love to say that the 20-year-old girls are not getting that message, but they are.
And you know what? The women in our 50s, if you are pushing back, I mean, we have a term now we didn't used to have, a Karen, that if you
Right.
actually make a legitimate complaint, then you're going to be called a Karen. If you're a woman who, you know, politics aside, Hillary Clinton was constantly called a bitch and a that, right? Because she's like a strong, smart woman who was being assertive.
Oh
But
yeah,
we're
even
called,
Taylor Swift, she gets
right.
dragged across the coals for being
For
great.
everything.
Just for
Right.
being great. You're the best in the
Right.
world. Must be
Right.
something wrong with you.
So women are damned if they, right. And Taylor Swift, by most accounts, I'm not even like a Swiftie or anything. I don't know half her songs, but by most accounts, she really goes out of her way to like give back to her employees and society and fans. She's crazy talented, but she's a woman who's put herself out there. She's successful. So that's part of it. And then also, and I think this is important too, I mentioned it, it's the natural fear of conflict that we all have in relationships, men too, because if we don't feel really adept with it and we don't know how to communicate constructively, then it feels like a threat to the bond to bring up something that, oh, well, I'll just get over it. But then third is the trauma piece where, you know, in therapy circles, we call it fawning, where, you know, it's just anything to not rock the boat because I feel so scared and terrified. And it can bring up younger parts of self in the moment that for an adult, you can't really be abandoned because you won't die. But a child, if a child is abandoned, a child will die. So if bringing something up feels like it's going to push somebody away or make them judge you or you lose the relationship, that can bring up a younger self inside that just wants to fawn, people please, appease. Oh, I said that, or I floated that idea indirectly and you raised your voice and left the room. I'm never going to bring that up again. That doesn't go well. And then the sad part is over time we get the short-term comfort, but over time we lose ourselves. It's
Yes,
self-abandonment.
self-abandonment. All right. So, and to draw, just to make sure that everybody in the audience is on the same page, the fawn reference that you made is part of that list of stress responses, which is fight, flight, freeze. And then people don't mention it all the time, but the other one is fawning, which is like a little baby deer,
Yes.
trying to be cute and non-threatening so that you don't raise conflict. All right. So, very good. I
It's a,
could
right,
talk.
it's a survival strategy.
Yeah, and I like to, when I talk to my friends, because I'm not a therapist, but when I talk to my friends and people I'm having conversations with, I do always say, I'm like, don't sell yourself short here when you find out that you did this, because you developed these coping mechanisms because they were needed at some point or another. And now you're in a spot to like grow up and, put on your big girl panties and learn some new skills.
Yes, and this is the whole process that I teach in my book, that is how to not let those survival responses run the show anymore
Oh my
because they're
goodness.
so natural, but we as mature adults, we can come from that wise self in communication and ground ourselves and still get our point across.
So that is a perfect thing. We're going to talk about your book in a second. I have one final question, and I could talk to you
Yes.
all day, but I said, who did you tell first when you decided that you want to divorce your first husband? Who did you tell, and how was the idea received by your parents who had this Catholic family and all of the things?
So the first person I told was this horrible marriage counselor. Right? And then after that, it was my parents. I did go right to my parents. And, you know, they at that point, I have to say, they were very supportive. My mom was worried for me, and it turned out in ways that I should have been more tuned into myself. She was like, "You don't really have a career. You have young babies. My parents lived in New York. I was here by myself." I got kind of a storyline floated in our friend group that wasn't totally fair to me, in my opinion. And everybody kind of thought I was the one who chose the divorce. So everyone thought I was the bad guy. This is another place where I think women are really vilified, right? To be a woman And to leave your husband when you have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, society doesn't like that. And I had very good reasons that were very painful and private that I chose not to share out of respect for my ex-husband's career. But of course, nobody knew that or cared about it. So I really lost most of my friends too. So it was received well by my parents, but definitely not by our social circle. I had one friend laughingly, it's such a Real Housewives moment. This is 20 years ago, but sobbing to me when I told her about my divorce because I was going to mess up the rental in Hilton Head.
Oh, well, that doesn't actually surprise me. I'm old enough to have seen my fair share of those stories. And there is a very real social cost of decoupling from a relationship. It's the friend group, it's the schools, it's the after school activity. I've talked to hundreds of women who are very happy to be divorced. I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody who enjoyed the process of detangling in the relationship. It is a rough
Definitely,
process,
Amy.
unfortunately.
Yep.
All right. So we have mentioned that you're a therapist. For everybody who's listening, you have a couple of podcasts. One is called The Insights from the Couch, Real Talk for Women in Midlife. And there's another one, and you're on the radio in Orlando. Very, very cool. And notably for right now, very, very timely, you've written a book that is coming out the week that this show releases. The book is called The Cost of Quiet: How to Have the Hard Conversations That Create Secure, Lasting Love. All right. Is there anything that I missed in that wrap-up of the things that you've got going on?
No, I mean, except that I also did a TEDx talk called
TEDx talk.
Secrets of a Couples Therapist. So, and that's on, I think listeners would get a lot out of that. And there's a lot of what we talked about today. And then I go into some more depth on some of these issues. And thanks so much for mentioning my book. It's just coming out now. And I really, it was inspired to give women. And women in particular, it's for everyone, but I wrote it for women. And I say that in the book because I'm a woman and my experience, I give a very actionable solution, including like scripts that's kind of like emotional Mad Libs. So you put your own stuff, it's your own truth, but I really help you learn how to communicate for your feelings and needs, regardless of how your partner responds. And that's my mission in life, is to help people with that.
I love that. I absolutely love it. All right. I'll put all of the links to the podcast, the book, and the TEDx talk are in the show notes on all the audio platforms and on YouTube for everybody in the audience. The easiest way, in my opinion, as the host, to get all of these links is to be subscribed to the Imperfect Adulting email newsletter, which I call the Village. And then the links are in there and you just click on them and it's like magic. You don't have to hunt them up. So that's my opinion. Everybody's invited. Colette, are you ready for my final three random questions?
I am, and I can't wait.
I love that you're so excited about this. Some people get
I
nerve. Some people get nervous, and they're just ridiculous questions. All right, so question number one: if I came into your house and opened your refrigerator today, which would be absolutely a very strange thing to do, but let's go with it. I think it makes a funny question. What would I find in your fridge today?
You would find a bunch of stuff that my husband bought at the grocery store and cooked. I'm an empty fridge girl. I'm gonna grab something on the go, but my husband is so good. He does all the grocery shopping and all the cooking. So you'd find like macaroni that's like not real pasta. It's like some healthy, grainy stuff. A bottle of champagne that hasn't been opened yet, and probably some cheese and butter and whatever my husband's eating. I'm on the go.
You're on the go. All right, I love that. Okay. If you were number two, if you were going to redecorate a room in your house, what room would you choose? And what furniture store do you think would be your first stop for buying new furniture?
Oh my gosh, I would love to do that. So I have a tiny house. I would redecorate the front room, which is my home office, and it's open. I actually like how it looks, but I would love to like freshen it up. I don't know the store because I know nothing about designing, but I would want a very clean, like very South Florida vibe, just like wood and plants and like everything white and light and maybe something really blue, like the ocean for artwork on the wall. Just really clean aesthetic.
That coastal chic that makes so
Yes,
much
coastal
sense.
chic. Yes,
Yes,
that's what I would want.
That is a vibe that looks, we all have it. One of the reasons is because everything gets so bleached in Florida. So it's like you're
Yeah.
better off just starting with white furniture because it
Yes, and
all
I
ends up
love
white.
it. Mine is gray and yellow and it's nice, but I would rather the coastal chic vibe.
Very cool. All right. You are an author and a podcaster and a broadcaster yourself. Do you want to share with us either a podcast or a book that isn't your book? Because we already talked about your book, that you enjoy that you think somebody in the audience might also like.
All right, I'm going to go with what came right to my mind, an oldie but goodie, one of my favorites, and one of the only books I've ever reread multiple times is Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Susan Jeffries. She's no longer with us. For anybody that's ever wanted to go for something and felt fear, which is natural, anybody who's dealt with anxiety but is like a super smart, powerful person at the same time, this is your book.
Love that. I'd heard that phrase so many times. I don't think I knew that there was a book to go
Sure.
with it. That is fantastic. That's it. Colette Fair, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks to you all for listening.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.